Hello, I'm Lina Khmudu. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we will have a discussion on the cholera and Ebola outbreaks in Africa. But first, two cases of measles have been confirmed in New York City as of the end of February, according to the New York City Health Department. According to NYC's Health Department, the two cases are unrelated, with one occurring earlier this year. Measles was declared officially eliminated in the U.S. in 2000, but cases have been on the rise in recent years. According to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, there have been 164 cases across the U.S. as of February 27, spreading in several states, including Alaska, California, New York, Rhode Island, and Texas. 20% of those cases have resulted in hospitalization. Texas has had the biggest outbreak with 146 cases and last week reported the country's first measles death since 2015. Health authorities are urging parents to vaccinate their children. Now to Uganda, the country is battling a Sudan strain Ebola outbreak with a second death confirmed in a child from Kampala. Uganda declared the outbreak of the highly infectious and often fatal hemorrhagic disease in January in the capital, Kampala, after the death of a male nurse at the East African country's Seoul National Referral Hospital. Authorities had previously stated the outbreak was contained after eight of the people known to be infected had received treatment and recovered. The United Nations has launched an emergency appeal to raise $11.2 million to help fund Uganda's response to the Ebola outbreak. In a statement sent out on Tuesday, the UN said the funds will cover the Ebola response from March to May in seven high-risk districts. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization has reported over 34,700 new cases of cholera and acute watery diarrhea across 19 countries, with Africa seeing the highest number. For more perspectives on the outbreaks, I spoke with Dr. Patrick Otim, Health Emergency Officer with the WHO Africa region. Take a listen.
You know, Ebola as a one of the viral hemorrhagic fevers is a disease that we always take very seriously, learning from where we have come from the largest outbreak in 2014. So whenever we have an outbreak like this, we pay very close attention to it. Now, we had hoped that we were going to contain this outbreak much more quickly because the cases that were initially confirmed were treated and discharged, and we had a period of around 1 week without a case. But in the last 3 days, we did have confirmation from the Ministry of Health in Uganda that a new case was confirmed. This case is currently being investigated. There are links being established to the initial cluster of cases, but they have to work much pretty fast to be able to identify all the contacts and monitor them as well as interrupt the transmission. So our concern is how fast they can be able to go in terms of identifying all the contacts that are there and work to interrupt the transmission, which is the most important objective in the response currently.
So would you say that the strategy mainly at this point is about contact tracing?
Well, it's a comprehensive response looking at different strategies. Of course, the case investigation, identification, listing and follow-up of contacts is the main starting point so that we have to identify the cases and contacts, but also community engagement, ensuring that the community cooperates with the public health interventions, that they are able to report to health facilities when they are not feeling well is a very important aspect of the response. It's actually at the core of this. But also, we have been implementing a clinical trial in Uganda as part of the interventions to try to identify a vaccine for Sudan virus. So the clinical trial is also ongoing, targeting the contacts and their contacts, as well as then scaling up clinical management so that we can be able to initiate early and comprehensive care for the cases. And you, as you saw, in the last cohort of eight cases, all of them were managed effectively and they recovered and were discharged. So that is the kind of strategy that we want to continue to encourage, along with infection prevention and control in the community, and ensuring that we protect through surveillance at the points of entry so that there is no exportation of cases.
Given the lessons from previous Ebola outbreaks, what improvements have been made to prevent further spread?
So there have been a number of improvements. One of the things I would like to highlight that has played out in this response recently has been how we manage contacts. And in the recent cluster of cases, there was rapid identification of contacts, and an attempt was made to interrupt or reduce their interaction with the rest of the members of the public. So putting them in designated facilities that have been established by the government so that they can be monitored for 21 days. So this measure helped to ensure that all the 8 new cases that were identified, there was no other secondary cases linked to them, which means that when they developed symptoms, they were alone. They were not in contact with other people. And that is a very important lesson. Of course, there are other critical issues, ensuring that we put the community at the center. That when we do measures such as safe and dignified burials, that we are doing that respecting the cultures, respecting the religious beliefs of the population, so that we don't, go against their wishes. So we work with them, ensuring that we implement prevention and control measures, but also being sensitive to the cultures and religious beliefs. And then we have seen the added benefit of medical countermeasures such as vaccines. As we saw with the approved vaccines against the Ebola virus disease, as well as other therapeutics like monoclonal antibodies. And these are things that are being tried so that we can reduce the case fatality rate for Ebola.
Now let's turn to cholera. The African region has recorded the highest number of cholera cases. There have been multi-country outbreaks of cholera. What specific challenges are contributing to this trend, and what measures are being taken to address them?
Thank you very much. Cholera, as we say, is a disease of lack. It happens in a context where we have the population doesn't have access to clean water, there are inadequate sanitation facilities, and therefore it thrives in that context. And there are a number of challenges within our region that have been contributing to more or less continuous outbreaks we have had since 2021 within the region. The number one are development issues. As we know, access to water and sanitation is a development issue. And the number of the outbreaks we are having are in peri-urban areas, areas that are rapidly developing, and the extension of clean water and services to those areas is not commensurate to the population needs. So you have outbreaks happening in that context. The second one is the climate. We have seen adverse climatic events. We have seen droughts in the Greater Horn of Africa, but we have also seen cyclones and flooding in the southern parts of Africa. So this flooding disrupts the infrastructure, causes flooding of water and latrines and contamination, and thereby driving the transmission. The other issue that is very critical is conflict. Currently, we have a number of conflicts that are active within the region, and we have seen a number of, when people are displaced, they no longer have access to safe water and sanitation, and therefore cholera thrives in that context. We have seen in DRC, we have seen in parts of Ethiopia, and those are things that are very, very difficult to deal with. And lastly, of course, is the issue of the health system as well. So the health system in some context is weak. The multi-sectoral response also that you require, because cholera is not a health issue. We just manage the consequence. It is the issue of providing water and sanitation. And most times when we have an outbreak, all the eyes look at the health sector, but not bringing on board critical partners like the ministries of water and sanitation, the local government authorities who are responsible for hygiene and sanitation in the community. So it really an issue of that lack of multi-sectoral coordination that helps to address the underlying cause of cholera.
So, WHO reported 349 cholera-related deaths in January. You say cholera is not a health issue. What are the key gaps in treatment and response that need urgent attention?
So in January, we had over 300 deaths. As of Last week, towards the end of February, we had already reached 670 deaths within the region. We always say, as WHO, that in this day and age, nobody should be dying from cholera. And that's why we've set a benchmark that in every cholera outbreak, less than 1% of the cases should die. So the case fatality ratio should be less than 1%. And what is the magic bullet for cholera? It is the rehydration. So ensuring that the person, the fluids that they are losing, you are able to replace it. So the number one issue is the issue of lack of access, immediate access to the rehydration, to the treatment. Sometimes the facilities are very far. Some of the communities, they do not have a facility nearby. And therefore, you have those issues that you have a lot of deaths because people get to the health facility very late when they cannot be resuscitated adequately. So addressing the access issue is a critical one. The supplies, managing a case of severe cholera with dehydration, you need a high amount of oral rehydration solution as well as intravenous fluids. And those intravenous fluids, you need to have them closer to where the populations are so that they can be able to use them. And of course, the clinical expertise, you need to have clinicians who are trained, who know how to detect dehydration and how to manage it. And those in some areas, you may not have a sufficient number of healthcare workers or even the facilities that they can go to be able to receive the adequate care that they need to prevent death.
Oral cholera vaccine is utilized to prevent cholera. The production has increased to 6.2 million doses, according to report. Yet the demand still outpaces the supplies. What strategies is WHO considering to further boost production and ensure equitable distribution?
So the issue that we've had with oral cholera vaccines, which are a very good tool for prevention and control of cholera, has been that we only, as of this year, we still have one manufacturer in Korea that's making the vaccine. So, and there's limited capacity that they can produce in a month. And as you have rightly mentioned, we have a high number of countries that are having outbreaks. So the doses, every time the doses are being produced, they are being shipped out. So we don't even have a stockpile. So the immediate action that was taken initially was to suspend the two-dose strategy, so that now we only use one dose strategy, so that at least we can spread the doses thin and ensure that the communities that need them are able to receive. But there has been ongoing engagement with manufacturers to be able to boost production. So there have been engagement with the manufacturer in South Korea and manufacturer in India so that they can be able to produce more. But as a region, we have also been advocating that we need to have manufacturing of oral cholera vaccine within the region because we are one of the regions that's mostly affected. And we were excited when BioVac in South Africa did announce that they are making investments to be able to enable them to produce the vaccines. And we have been encouraging that and engaging with them. Of course, expanding capacity to manufacture may take time, but those are strategic engagements that have been ongoing to ensure that we have an increased production of oral cholera vaccines to meet the demand that is there.
How effective is a one-dose vaccination?
So there have been a number of studies that have been done, and they show that the one-dose strategy is effective. Because, you know, when you get two doses, it gives you protection of at least 3 to 5 years. When you get the one dose, it gives you protection at least 1 year. So it's ideally supposed to be a measure that buys us time so that we address the water and sanitation issue. But it also helps to reduce the severity of the disease and helps us to interrupt transmission. So it's been a very effective tool once we are able to deploy it effectively early in the response and targeted at the hotspots where there are transmission ongoing.
There are seasonal decline in cholera outbreaks, for example, during winter. What are the projections for the coming month and how can countries prepare?
So in our region, for instance, we have now we've been having cholera all year round, that it's really the variation is attached to the rainfall patterns within the region. So, for instance, from December to up to April, where you have a lot of rains and cyclones in the Southern Africa sub-region, you have cholera happening. Now we have Angola and Mozambique, for instance, having cholera outbreaks. And then it will shift to West Africa when we reach May, June, when the rainy season starts. So we've been working with the countries. We have a system. We have a cholera readiness assessments that we do before the cholera season to assess the readiness of the system to detect and respond effectively. And once we do those assessments, we identify the gaps. We work with the countries to do training of healthcare workers to pre-position the supplies, the adequate supplies that are needed for cholera, to develop their response plan so that when they get a new case, they are able to activate the response and address the challenge. But also we have been engaging proactively on the issue of investment in water and sanitation, engaging with countries, because that is the only solution that is going to help us. So we do what is called identification of priority areas for multisectoral interventions, the PAMIs. And once we have identified, previously we used to call them hotspots, the potential hotspots for cholera, we engage with the governments and say, these are the most vulnerable areas. You need to be able to invest in water and sanitation in these areas so that we reduce the risk for cholera.
And finally, Dr. Otim, what would you tell communities to protect themselves?
So cholera is a very easy disease to prevent. There are really critical things. One is the hygiene and sanitation. So maintaining hygiene is very, very critical. Ensuring that the drinking water is treated. Most times, if you are in an area where you don't have piped clean water, so you have to boil your drinking water and ensure that it is covered in a narrow neck vessel where it cannot be contaminated. Ensuring that the food is properly cooked, that hygiene is maintained during the preparation and serving of the food, that it is kept and eaten while it is hot. Ensuring that human remains, that there is no open defecation being done, that all human remains and waste are properly disposed. And then ensuring that, you know, you wash your hands critically before eating, you know, before using toilet. Those are measures that are very, very critical. And if you are in an area where there's an active outbreak and you are offered the oral cholera vaccine, you take it so that it can help strengthen your immune system to be able to prevent against the disease. Or if you do catch it, at least you will not have a severe disease that can quickly lead to death.
Dr. Patrick Otim, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Patrick Otim, Health Emergency Officer with the WHO African Region. You are listening to Health Chat on Voice of America. It's time for a short break. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Are you looking for a show that keeps you in the know and gets you talking? Then tune in to Upfront with Jackson Bungani on the Voice of America.
So you have to have balance. Every day I give myself goals for the day, things for me to accomplish.
On Upfront, nothing is off the table. We dive into politics, the latest trends, lifestyle, health, entertainment, and everything that touches your life. Tune in each Wednesday to Sunday or stream it live at voaafrica.com.
Hi there, I'm Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings as we make our way through the month of February. We've got a great interview coming up with a American Idol finalist, and his name is Will Mosley. And I voted for him. I cheered for him. I typically don't vote for artists on the TV shows, but this guy I did vote for. And he's going to join us on Tuesday with his music and his story. Tune us in at 1500 Universal, Border Crossings on the Voice of America.
Welcome back to Health Chat. As countries face increasing risks of climate-related disasters in the Horn of Africa, a trade bloc has partnered with humanitarian organizations to develop a disaster preparedness program to enhance early warning systems and strengthen risk management across the 8 member states. Juma Majanga reports from Nairobi.
Climate extremes are becoming a familiar pattern across the world. Experts say the effects have been devastating in the Horn of Africa due to a lack of preparedness. An 8-country trade bloc is coming up with solutions. The Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, has developed an anticipatory action plan to help the region's member states minimize losses caused by climate disasters. As Ahmed Abdihoun, IGAD's Regional Program Manager for Disaster Risk Management, explains.
We are trying to provide a guidance as IGAD, as a regional body, to help countries and the region transition towards anticipation, which is also in par with the climate crisis narrative, the development narrative, but also most importantly on how to address the humanitarian needs and the humanitarian crisis that seems to be perennial in the IGAD region.
The IGAD Anticipatory Action Plan provides member countries and other partners with a roadmap for putting in place necessary measures before disasters strike. The process begins at the IGAD Climate Prediction and Application Center in Nairobi, Kenya, where staff members monitor disasters, collect data, and analyze early disaster indicators. The findings are then communicated to member states through alerts or advisories. As Julie Ouma, a geographic information system analyst at IGAD, explains.
Since all major hazards within our region are climate-related, so getting early warning in terms of extreme weather and climate issues will form anticipatory action in terms of disasters.
The anticipatory plan is being implemented in partnership with key humanitarian organizations with operations in the region, including the World Food Programme Eastern Africa and the UN Food and Agricultural Organization, or FAO. FAO Kenya's Hamisi Williams says climate change has affected Africa's food production and productivity.
It has also affected our levels of trade, you know, the entire system. And that means that it has overly reduced the ability of us to have nutritious food on the table.
Williams says having an anticipatory action plan can help the region better cope with future disasters.
We saw how every time we play catch-up with these disasters. But if we have a defined roadmap like now and we follow the roadmap, then what we are trying to do now is to say we are going to be ahead of the disaster when it comes.
IGAD's Amdi Hoon says implementation of the action plan offers a win-win situation for governments and communities in the region.
If the risk, as you anticipate, materializes, that means you have averted a big catastrophe to the communities, to their assets, to their livelihoods, and so on. If it doesn't unfold the way you expected it, you have still invested on communities.
The Horn of Africa has seen some of the worst climate-related disasters in recent years, including deadly droughts and subsequent flooding. Experts hope the regional transition from a reactive to a proactive approach to climate extremes will help protect vulnerable communities from their devastating impacts. Juma Majanga, VOA News, Nairobi.
Sudanese refugees who have made it to Chad speak of burying infants who died of hunger in Darfur's Zamzam displacement camp. Henry Wilkins has more.
ስሙ እንዲጠቀስ ያልፈለገው ተፈናቃይ ከዛምዛም መጠለያ ወጥቶ ሱዳንን ከቻድ በሚያዋስነው ድንበር ላይ ከሚገኘው ሌላ የተፈናቃዮች መጠለያ ደርሷል። በሰሜን ዳርፉር ከሚገኘው የዛምዛም መጠለያ ጀምሮ ያለውንና አስቸጋሪውን 340 ኪሎ ሜትር ርቀት መንገድ የተጓዘው በእግሩ ነው። መጠለያው ረሃብ የሚታይበትና ከሱዳን ሰራዊት ጋር በመዋጋት ላይ ባለው የፈጥኖ ደራሽ ኃይሉ ከበባ ውስጥ የሚገኝ ነው። ተፈናቃዩ ለደህንነቱ ሲል ስሙ እንዲጠቀስ አልፈለገም።
በዛምዛም እየሆነ ያለው አሳዛኝ ነው። ፍንዳታዎቹ ሰውን እየጨረሱ ነው። ገንዘብ የለም፣ ምግብ የለም። አንዳንዴ በቀን አንድ ጊዜ ነው የምንበላው።
እርሱና በዛምዛም መጠለያ የሚገኙ ሌሎች
The United Nations Children's Fund says worsening insecurity in the DRC's rebel-controlled cities of Goma and Bukavu is making it extremely difficult to feed and care for thousands of children and women. John James is a communications specialist for UNICEF. He tells VOA's Chinedu 4 that with the airport out of use, warehouses looted and infections soaring, time is running out to save thousands of lives.
The situation is not yet under control. And now is really the time to act, to make the investments, to support the governments, particularly of Democratic Republic of Congo and Burundi, but also other countries in the region as well, to respond to the outbreak, but also to prepare. The virus is behaving differently in different contexts, and there are different variants of the virus. So there's still a lot that we are learning. For example, in Burundi, there hasn't been any deaths, whereas here in DRC, there's been quite a considerable number of deaths, around 700 or 800 so far. There are other underlying issues. For example, there are issues related to children who are malnourished. There are issues related to undiagnosed HIV/AIDS. There are underlying issues around water and sanitation issues, for example. And so we're still trying to understand the contextual factors as to what leads this to being more severe in some children and then in other countries being less severe.
A few months ago, there was this concern about mpox vaccine coming into that area. A few weeks ago, there were reports that some got in. Do you have enough mpox vaccine? What is the current situation in terms of availability?
There's always a lot of interests in vaccines. I think the first thing I'd want to say is that vaccines are not a silver bullet for responding to this outbreak. This is very much an outbreak which needs a whole range of interventions to control it. Risk communication and community engagement is critically important so that people are aware of the virus, what it can do, how they can protect themselves, if they get it, how to get help. We need to improve infection prevention and control in communities, in schools and public spaces. And we need to make sure that people are well nourished and are immunocompetent so that if they get the disease, their bodies are actually able to handle it. Those things are critically important to breaking community transmission in this outbreak.
What kind of pressures are you and your staff facing in dealing with this problem?
There's a number of different pressures that the staff face. I mean, one is the operating context. I was in a school yesterday in Equateur province in the northwest of Democratic Republic of Congo, and there was no water in the school. Well, that's a real challenge if you look at infection prevention control procedures, for example.
Over the past 6 years, the BEAT tuberculosis study has revealed a promising new oral treatment against drug-resistant TB. Zahir Kasim reports.
These pills are part of a drug trial in South Africa that may help revolutionize tuberculosis therapy. A new regimen cured 85 to 90% patients with drug-resistant TB, up from 50% for previous regimens.
We found safe and effective treatment for pregnant women and children, but also we've awakened the field to say, actually, this has to be done.
Women, children, and men in the BEAT tuberculosis trial all received the same regimen. That's a change from previous treatments, even though TB often affects entire families.
The daddy gets one easy regimen to take, and then the mom gets a more complicated one because she's pregnant, and the child gets an even more complicated one. Dad is cured after 6 months, mom is cured after 8 months, and we wait for 18 months for us to be able to know if a child is cured. So that's really an unfortunate set of circumstances.
Dr. Pauline Howell supervised the study. She says the new regimen has the backing of the World Health Organization.
That basically means that countries can take the recommendation of the regimen and run with it, which is fantastic, because the more options we give countries to work with, the more options we can then translate to patients who need treatment.
Leslie Marbury is Southern African Mission Director for the United States Agency for International Development. She says breakthroughs like this new treatment could eventually pave the way for a world free of, or at least less troubled by, TB.
They're coming from high-burden countries like South Africa, who are motivated, then I feel confident that we can end tuberculosis as a global health challenge.
TB claims over 1 million lives each year, but experts say with early detection, simplified treatment regimens. Sahil Kassim, VOA News, Johannesburg, South Africa.
And that's all for this edition of Health Chat. Thank you all for joining us, and thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Linoch Mudu, in Washington, with producer Jackson Vunganyi. Until next time, take care, stay safe, and strive to make every day a healthy day.